Happy Christmas, Doctor. And happy Christmas to everyone else, too.
Merry Christmas! You're listening to Pieces of Eight, the Doctor Who podcast that's here to bring you an added piece of Christmas cheer. We're bringing you the surprise episode, which I didn't know about until Kenny sprung it upon me yesterday, as we've got a Christmas treat in store, apparently. I'm not going to lie, I am scared, I am nervous, but I'm also very excited to find out what this is.
Yeah.
We are continuing on our exploration of those sections of the Doctor Who universe that feature the incarnation of the Time Lord as played by Paul McGann. I'm Rebecca Chapman.
And I'm Kenny Smith, and Merry Christmas to you, Becca. And of course, a very Merry Christmas to little Arthur in your tummy.
I know, I'm so excited.
Yeah, that was an absolute wonderful piece of news, and thank you for sharing that with us yesterday.
Of course.
It was fantastic. And listeners, Merry Christmas to you. You join us as we resume our quest to feature the Eighth Doctor's exploits, whether on screen in books, novellas, fullcast audio, short stories, comic books, comic strips, animations, talking books, magazines, and more. And today, I've got a Christmas present for you, and one for you as well, Becca. But we'll start off with the listeners' Christmas present, first of all. Did you know, Becca, that the original version of the TV movie began with a narration from the Master, which was ultimately never used?
I didn't.
Well, there you go. Well, I recently was having a look on YouTube just for McGann-related content, just in case there was anything inspiring or something of use, and I found a copy of the audio from that, which was performed by the actor Gordon Tipple on YouTube. And I thought it might be quite good fun if we were to clean that up a wee bit and pop it onto the TV movie soundtrack opening and hear how it would have sounded. So it's a little bonus Christmas present, and this is how it sounds.
I do hereby make my last will and testament. If I'm to be executed and thus cruelly deprived of all existence, I ask only that my remains be transported back to my home planet by my rival Time Lord and Nemesis, he who calls himself the Doctor.
So we get to the Master doing his little bit, and it sounds quite weird. So, yeah. So there you go. That's a little present for you, listeners. But of course, we do need to have a present for you as well, Becca. But we'll come to that shortly. Let's have a quick chat about Doctor Who at Christmas. What are your favourite Christmas episodes?
Are we talking specifically Paul McGann here?
Oh, no, specifically Christmas, Doctor Who Christmas episodes on the telly. It could be David Tennant, whoever he is, and the likes.
Well, I really like the Christmas Invasion.
How can you?
Christmas Invasion is probably my favourite.
Yeah, I think there's so much going on. I mean, the whole bit with the Santa, with the robot Santas trying to kill, and the deadly Christmas tree, and then the line was from Jackie going, "I'm going to be killed by a Christmas tree," And
I was just about to say that.
But I think there's that brilliant visual gag of the tree having come through the doorway, and then afterwards when they leave, that the shape of the tree has been cut into the door like something out of a Tom and Jerry.
Yes, and it is absolutely brilliant, and I love it so much. And we see David Tennant for the first time properly
revived by a cup of tea.
He is just brilliant.
Yes, he is. And he just absolutely sets the way for what we're going to get over the next few years. But of course, I suppose in some ways we'd already had a Christmas episode at that point with The Unquiet Dead with Chris Eccleston. I tend to think of it as a Christmas episode, even though it was shown in, April? But it's got that setting and it's got the snow, and there's just something rather wonderful about it. And I like to consider that as like a bonus Christmas episode.
I know my partner, almost said his name then. My partner and I recently, because we've reached Matt Smith in our Doctor Who rewatch, and we recently watched the Tennant episode with Victoria, the next Doctor.
Mystery guest will be joining us very, very soon.
Ooh, I'm terrified.
Don't be terrified, because it's something that will chew you up. And I think our guest might even have a little present with them, but we will find out who they are and what they come bearing very, very soon. So yeah, I mean, my favourite Christmas ones are, like you, I love The Christmas Invasion. I really, really enjoy The Runaway Bride, because obviously it gives us our first glimpse of the wonderful Donna Noble. Little did we realise what was to come. Voyage of the Damned is just great fun. It's just sort of Doctor Who does disaster movie. Budget ramped up, it would seem. And of course, we get our first glimpse of Bernard Cribbins and Kylie. And it just goes off in such a wonderful, wonderful journey, and it's so well made, and you can see why it's the highest rated Doctor Who story of all time, I think, now. Or if not, maybe it's not the highest rated, but it's the highest 21st century episode, and the fact it was number one in the TV listings as well, so that is also very pleasing. I was quite pleasantly surprised when that came through, but I remember watching it for the first time just thinking, this is great. And then of course we go through the Matt Smith episodes, some good ones there. Christmas Carol's good. We mentioned the Doctor Widow in the wardrobe the other day. And yeah, I think there's some good stuff. And then of course, I still think the Time of the Doctor could have been six episodes with that, all the stuff going on in Trenzalore, and we could have seen the Doctor aging slowly but surely. It could have been a mini series in its own right.
Yes.
Instead of having to say goodbye to Matt so sadly at the end. And then of course we did get the wonderful PCAP, so yeah, always happy to Peter Capaldi and his Christmas episodes are fun. Haven't watched The Return of Doctor. Oh, what's this? What's this? There's somebody joining your call, Becca. Wait.
Finally.
Hello.
Who's this? Hello. Who's our special Christmas guest? You better introduce yourself for the listeners, because we're recording live.
Well, I am Steve Cole. I have the same initials as Santa Claus, so I'm here at Christmas. Yes. I don't think I've spoken quite enough on these podcasts, so I felt I had to come and visit you with a special Christmas greeting.
Merry Christmas, Steve. How are you?
Very good. Thank you very much. Very good. What a lovely time of year it is, eh?
I think somebody's been stunned into silence.
Hello.
Hello.
You've been tiptoeing around me as I've sat on the various floor cushions and exotic rugs, and yet here I am. Here I am, finally making my presence known to you. Congratulations, by the way, on your splendid news, which you announced back in way back in podcast one, as I recall.
Yeah.
All those years ago.
Oh yes. Thank you so much. We found out the sex yesterday.
Well, and is that how the baby came about?
It is.
Well, that's good to know. That's good to know.
Oh, it's wonderful to see you, Steve. And we do have to say a huge thanks for joining us throughout the series, because it's been wonderful just to hear your insights and thoughts on the whole creative process. And it's been a real joy and a real labour of love.
Well, if 25-year-old Steve Cole would have known that someday there'd be interest and appreciation for those books, I'm sure he would have been a very happy younger man. he's a vaguely happy older man, but no, it's nice to look back on those times. And actually, you know, because until you actually are pressed to remember, a lot of it just, you know, sleeps in your mind. Obviously the occasional horror horror story that occurred during the making of one will come back unbidden as you thank your stars that you're still alive. But yes, it's been very nice to go back and to hear some of those voices I used to hear on my phone so often each day, because most of the business was obviously conducted by telephone, although we had email. Phone calls hadn't become something you didn't like to do in case they disturbed somebody. They were just something you did to get business done in an office environment. So, yeah, and I would have lengthy calls with so many of the authors. So, yeah, it's been lovely that you've tracked down so many of them and brought those, both the voices and the faces, back to me. So, yeah, that's been a treat.
Did you learn anything new that you didn't know from the authors?
Well, yes. Often, even if only context for what was going on with them at the time. Afraid I was sort of too busy, sort of like panicking, running around, worrying about what I was, how I was ever going to cope with it all. So it's nice to hear their view on it, to know that, you know, that by and large, I think that they enjoyed the process of writing those books and the editing of them, which of course I enjoyed too. I enjoyed it so much, I never did it in work at all. So I suppose you could say it counted as my leisure time was filled with editing Doctor Who books. Admittedly, because there was no choice, but also because, you know, at the end of the day, man, it's like I feel it now. I'm just editing a Target novelization before I broke off to say hello to you. Ooh. And yes, and so it's lovely to be still doing it. You know, still working with authors on Doctor Who fiction.
Are you allowed to say what it is?
Of course not. Of course, I can't reveal what it is. But there's some very exciting books coming up in 2023. I have to say, maybe someday, 25 years from now, as a 76-year-old, I'll be telling you all about them for your latest podcast.
Oh, goodness gracious me. But also, I see that you're holding in your hands there what looks like a beautifully fully formed MP3, Steve.
Well, yes, I thought that I would give you a little gift to express my appreciation for all the incredible hard work you guys have put into this podcast. I mean, like, daily episodes. When first you told me that was the plan, I thought, oh, crazy young fools, will nothing stop them in this strange enterprise? But no, you pressed on, and yeah, it was remarkable. So I thought that, as it's Christmas, I would record a reading of a story called Evergreen that appeared in a Big Finish anthology of short stories for Christmas, edited by Paul Cornell. It should have been a Tara Sam story, really, except Paul said, no pseudonyms. So, fair enough, I thought, and it became a Stephen Cole story instead.
Wow. So, shall we pop it on now, and then we'll come back and have a quick chat about it?
Yeah, make a cup of hot cocoa and pull up a marshmallow and sit down feeling thoroughly festive for the creepy, mystifying story, Evergreen.
Doctor Who, Short Trips, Evergreen, by Stephen Cole, read by the author. "'Tis a difficult time for her, Christmas, I know. But really, she will have no decorations in the house, no festive food, no trimmings. Honestly, not so much as a pudding to wish on. She'll give no gifts and refuse any offered. Tain't Christian. I know she's grieving, but tain't Christian. She's done up the church right nice this year, but if goodwill's not in her heart, I hope the Reverend be watching her come Candlemas, that's all. 'Tis a miracle none of us be lying in the sod after what she'd done." "What did you do, Connie?" John asked her in the cottage that night, after the pork was salted and hanging in the byre. "What happened at Candlemas?" Connie pursed her lips as she ladled his soup into the bowl. "Tongues wagging in the village, are they?" He nodded. "In the butcher's, at any rate. I heard Mrs. Bledlow talking to Mrs. Gould." She sniffed. Some say the Bledlows rig their scales, but mark you, you'll always get a full portion of tongue from her. John chuckled and left it at that. But now Connie felt uncharitable. Still, she added, Mr. Bledlow never gives me less money than's due for the meat. Maybe a little more these last months. He's a good man, John agreed, and drained his tankard of beer. He set it down on the table with a thump and tore off some bread from yesterday's loaf. Connie eyed him, absorbed now in his meal, dunking his bread and pressing it all into his mouth like a child showing off. And yet still he had about him the serious look of a composer or a sculptor, with the high brow and the piercing blue eyes and the curls of chestnut hair. And goodness knew he was a man of learning. Her Charles had never so much as looked at a book, yet John devoured them with the same delight as he tore into his evening meal each night. The cottage had seemed so empty, so cold and dark since Candlemas, and she with it, mindless at first of the trees through the window as they regained their leaves and sprightly colour, then knowing and bitter as they burnt off their coats in crisp reds and browns, to stand stick-like again. But John could fill the cottage with a satisfied belch, or a noisy yawn, or a few puffs of hard breath from the long climb up the hill. He had approached her at October's end, a simple traveller looking for lodgings in return for labour. She had agreed, knowing full well she'd let things go to pot around here. Charles had always worked so hard and yet made so little. Now all she'd got was the small holding. She'd spent whole days sometimes watching his animals wasting and the yard filling with muck, watching it happen and selfishly wishing Charles had taken as long to die. That night, John fed the fire, then perched on the rickety armchair with a handsome bound book. Connie sat in Charles's rocker and watched him turn the pages. He would read to her some nights, which she enjoyed, not knowing the look of words herself. What is it tonight? She asked him. The Interpretation of Dreams by Sigmund Freud, he murmured. Is it an exciting story? She asked. It's taken your attention. It's not a novel, he told her gently, and she blushed. He's a scientist. He believes our dreams betray our preoccupations and our problems, that through study they may shed light on our natures. Whoever heard of such a thing? Connie snorted. Are the dream books not enough to go by? Any child can tell you what a dream means. John looked at her with interest. Can they? Aye, and with solemn eyes and heart they'll tell you 'tis the very truth. She cast her mind back to the maxim she'd been told as a child. To weep in a dream betokens bliss. To kiss the dead betokens a life to live. And should you dream of spoiled eggs, it is a sign of ill fortune. She forced a brief laugh. But it is all just fancies. In truth, there's no rhyme or reason to dreams or life alike, as far as I can see. John looked into the flames that shimmered in the grate. I dream each night, Mrs. Bride, of such things. Some marvellous and wonderful, and some so terrible that when I wake, I lay rocking myself for hours with no comfort. They listened together to the crackle and hiss of the fire. I don't believe I dream at all, she told him. She heard the wagging of tongues herself the next day in the baker's. The hot smell of freshly baked bread, smothering the hateful Christmas spice in the cold air, had lured her across the snowy, slippery street into a trap. I hear Connie's Christmas pudding broke open as she unwrapped it. That'll be what done it. Mrs. Bledlow, she holds how Connie cut her mince pie and so cut her luck. It was both, I reckon. Small wonder she brought down her poor husband. And then she does her darndest to bring down the whole lot of us. They look up as the bell above the door jangles, but Connie's gone already, bustling back up the hill, her basket empty and her cheeks scarlet. She sits and broods in her kitchen, watching John's comings and goings in the yard and the byre. He tramples muck and straw into the snow. The cold keeps back the smell of the animals, takes all comfort from the air. Only the scent of the spruces and the woods carries to her. She wonders if he will ask again what happened at Candlemas. A part of her dreads it, yet hopes that he shall. He stays silent all night, though, save to praise her cooking. He sees there's no bread, but makes no comment. He talks of the fresh snow falling like it's an adventure. And that night, Connie dreams of Meg Bledlow screaming and crying behind her counter, hiding from something that wants her dead. She sees young, smooth hands reaching into her hollering mouth and tugging out her tongue. Meg falls silent and our eyes close. Then Connie is looking in the old silver mirror above the butcher's counter, and she is a young girl. She pops the tongue in her mouth and swallows it daintily. She stares happily at herself in the glass for a long, long time. She can hear the steady seconds ticked off by the clock in her bedroom. The sound prods her into wakefulness and the cold grey morning. She feels puzzled at the images and hopes they will flee her head swiftly. But the dream lingers and pricks her like holly. She feels sour and sinful and mean-minded. At breakfast, she notices John's book and wonders if the meaning of her dream is hidden there in the print. But he has gone out early, so she cannot ask him. He returns at lunchtime, serious-looking, and instinctively she feels afraid. "Mrs. Bledlow is dead," he says. "Tom found her in the coal shed first thing. Uncanny, they're saying. Not a mark upon her, and never sick a day in her life." The whole village turned out to attend Meg Bledlow's funeral. Connie knew she must go herself despite the throng, and John accompanied her. As she'd expected, few welcomed her there. She hovered at the back of the crowd, noting the look of lilies and chrysanthemums with a disapproving eye. In times past, the villagers would always come to her to do the flowers. She remembered the festoon she'd made for Charles. It was not the flowers she remembered, but her hands, working them, sorting them like mechanical things, moved by her will, not her heart. Charles had been blind by the end in any case, her labours wasted, like the weeks spent attending his decline. Connie thought of her wreaths and garlands attending the church inside. As the service droned on, she had sweated and felt itchy before them, and was glad now to be out in the cold white daylight. She watched them lower the coffin into the black gash in the snow, a wooden tongue slipping into the cold mouth of earth, and she felt guilty and ashamed. Tears pricked her eyes, but she knew they were for herself, not Meg Bledlow. Mrs. Gould was casting hard looks in her direction, whispering to her neighbour. She could imagine their words. The nerve of the woman! Look at her standing with her man-friend, bold as brass. She killed Meg Bledlow, you know, surely as if she slit her throat. What she done pleased the evil one and let him in. The neighbour was nodding. Connie stared down at her feet, dabbing at her eyes. Maybe you're right, she thought. Maybe I did. She thought of Meg Bledlow's tongue, fat and wet and snaking as she chewed it in her sleep. To suffer annoyance from a snake, a token sight of an enemy, the dream scryers said. And in truth, she saw no friends about her in the churchyard, save the Reverend, perhaps, and John beside her. "One funeral makes three," Mrs. Gould said loudly. "Now death's come the once, he will again, and soon." John twisted some ivy from the overhanging tree near the crest of the hill. He showed it to Connie, but she wanted only to be home now, with time and space to gather her thoughts. "I'll not have the likes of that in my house," Connie snapped. "It's Christmas in a week," John protested. "The cottage could use some cheering up. You could." "There's the bar to litter if you're feeling so idle, John," she told him sharply. He dropped the ivy. "Life's too short to spend it sadly, Mrs. Bride." "I wish it were a good deal shorter," she shouted. "Short as a child's Christmas, I'd have it." She stormed away towards the cottage, but slipped in the snow and fell on her behind. She floundered, struggling to rise, willing herself not to weep. John's arm slipped awkwardly under hers to help her up. She accepted his help in silence, then pulled away and continued up the path to the cottage. "I don't believe what they say in the village," John called after her. "I should hope not," she snapped, panting for breath, her rump aching. "Superstitious fools they are, see wickedness in everything about them." John's smile was not quite cold enough to seem mocking. "Some even see it in a branch of evergreen." She pushed open the door, ready to storm in, but hesitated on the front step. The little hallway greeted her, bare and cheerless, stoic as the little heat it harboured flared out of the door. "I'll make us a brew," she muttered. "You get the fire started." "It's a simple enough story," she said. But she had never put it into words before, and it took some thinking about. John waited patiently, blowing on his scalding tea. "Charles fell ill last Christmas. Headaches first, terrible headaches. Then his sight went, and his mind not far behind it. Again she paused. John nodded slowly, understanding, encouraging. He fell ill the day I dressed the church for Christmas time. Been doing that for the Reverend since I was a little girl. For any special occasion, but especially Christmastide. Everyone keeps such a merry old Christmas these days. It's all so fashionable, isn't it? Changing the traditions. Folk in town, they don't know whether to take down the decorations on Twelfth Night, New Year's Day, Old Christmas Day, nor whether they should burn or bless the old wood once it's gone. But here in the village, we have them down by Candlemas Day, as we've always done. February the 2nd, John observed, and sipped his tea. Charles took a fever midway through January. She watched a wrinkled skin form over her own tea. He was in a terrible state. He grew mad. Word spread he'd been taken by devils. I tended him. By then, he couldn't do a thing by himself. John nodded thoughtfully. Did you have no help? Some came from the village. They urged me to open the doors so Charles' soul could fly free at the proper time. To turn the mirrors to the wall in case his likeness in death should be caught there. And I had their prayers, of course. She paused, scowled. But as Candlemas Eve neared, these good souls fretted and worried. First they begged, then they commanded I tear down the Christmas decorations, for they still lined the church hall. But Charles was so bad by then. He was looking at her blankly. Do they have no such superstitions where you have travelled, John? "'Tis unlucky to keep Christmas holly about the house after Candlemas Day, as the evil one will then come himself and pull it down. One might imagine he had better things to do, John murmured. Happened the good Lord did, right enough, than listening to village prayers and the pleas and witterings of a stupid old woman. You're neither, said John firmly. He drained his tea in a giant gulp. What was stopping the villagers taking down the decorations themselves? He who puts them up must take them down, said Connie. That's what the folk round here believe. If every scrap of Christmas decoration is not removed from church before Candlemas Day, there will be a death within a year in the family who takes the pew where a leaf or berry is left. John snorted. Nonsense. Like scrying dreams? Connie asked him pointedly. Look at Meg Bledlow. You said yourself they don't know how she died, so hail a woman. It wasn't from sitting on a berry, John countered. Went one berry nor a single leaf I left behind in that church on Candlemas Eve, said Connie fiercely. Though none shall believe me now. Nay, and though they watch me pull it down too. Charles lay bad that night, his head full of frets and nightmares, and that godly lot of honest souls, they came calling and half dragged me out of here to get the job done down at the church. Mrs. Gould sat with Charles so I would go. She felt her throat tightening, hastened to speak her story before the sobs could rise up. Such a commotion. That mithering lot sorrying for the trouble they'd put me to, but pointing to the dangers while I ripped down the rosemary and the mistletoe, half blind with tears, sweeping the filthy floor as midnight sounded from the church clock, and the fuss and the urging to be done ere the chimes stopped. I screamed at them for quiet. I'd done it near enough. John said nothing, just watched her from the rickety chair and nodded. She took comfort from the solidity of him. A short wash of tears streaked over her face, and her throat burned. But it was not the fit she feared would grip her. We all of us left the church in a foul temper. And when I got back, the windows and doors were all flung open and batting in the wind. The mirrors were turned. She blew her nose. I'd missed him go. They sat listening to the clock ticking. And now you won't keep Christmas? Asked John. Try to find goodwill in my heart, she whispered. The Reverend asked me to decorate the church again this year, though folk warned him against it. And I did, though I took no joy in doing so. But I'll not dress my house again, not for me, nor for you. Christmas is a time to look back on the past fondly. He paused. I travel, Mrs. Bride, because I cannot remember where my true home might be. Some years ago now, my memory fled me. Connie looked at him in surprise. Is it so? When I look to the past, I see only blackness, and I can feel some great dread upon me. Some memories are forever lost. Even if I recover, I can feel it. So I travel to make new memories. It's our memories that warm us when the world about us grows so cold, don't you think? He smiled unexpectedly. Perhaps I might hang a garland or two in the cowshed. Happen you may, she said grudgingly, and gave him a brief, self-conscious smile. You and the animals can keep a merry old Christmas in there together, John, just so you promise to leave me out of it. she came to regret the words. For leave her out, he did. Girl was found by Tom Bledlow the next day, naked in the snow at the fringe of the forest. John happened to be close by, gathering firewood. He helped Bledlow carry her back, covering her with his coat of scruffy velvet. They feared her dead or dying at first, but she soon revived in Bledlow's front room, the fire and the smell of good meat bringing the colour back to her white cheeks. She said she remembered not a thing, not her name nor where she came from. The snow was freshly fallen and had covered her tracks. There was no way of telling which path she'd tramped, but all agreed she'd not have got far, naked as a babe in arms. Bledlow sent off friends to ride out and ask around despite the blizzard. Some said that he took his finding the girl as a sign from Meg that she was hereabouts somehow, and not done with him yet. The girl was not beautiful by all accounts, but some said she had a beguiling air, and she had charmed John, it seemed. Connie guessed that when he looked in the girl's clouded eyes, he was seeing something of himself. He went to see the girl again the next day. He was off to Bledlow's anyway first thing with the Yuletide bacon and hams, but he needn't have stopped there. He had no call to. Still, he remained talking with the girl till afternoon. Connie broke up the icy kettle water in the trough herself with the pick. It reddened her hands, but calmed her spirit. The chore was John's, and when he saw it done without his stir, he would know she was not pleased. But he made no comment. When he returned, he simply bound up his sticks and vines and placed them round the byre, even hung a garland in the hayloft for his chucks. "The girl's run from something, Mrs. Bride," he told Connie at dinner that evening, with the air of a man keen to get something off his chest. "From some great evil, she believes." "Oh, yes." Connie raised an eyebrow. "What might that be? Can't recall, though she's trying." "Fancy," she sniffed. "Then how does she know she's run from evil? Evil may have sent her here."
"You wouldn't think so to look at her," said John. "Most think she's had a lucky escape."
"Well, Tom Bledlow's taken her in. He's a good man, and people side with him. She's landed on her feet, if you ask me."
John seemed pensive. The village is filled with talk of devils watching from the woods.
"So soon after Meg Bledlow was taken in her sleep, I'm not surprised," said Connie. "We're simple folk round these parts, John. Not what you're used to, I shouldn't wonder."
"One can't help but wonder," mused John forlornly. Connie knew he would go to see the girl again the next day.
She had no call to go to Tom Bledlow's that morning, but still she went. She took him a basket of eggs and some ripe cheese, told herself that with him wanting for a wife at Christmas, he could perhaps use the cheer. She bustled into his shop, pushing through the queue. Heads turned and noses twitched to see her there. "I brought you something, Tom Bledlow," she called to him. "It's for now, not for Christmas, so don't be saving it. I'll pop it in the pantry for you, and don't be thinking of putting it on your counter neither. I'll not have you selling goods you've not paid for."
Tom looked peaky, but his bushy moustaches still twitched with a smile for her.
"You'll not buy better rates from me, Connie Bride," he told her, "but I thank you for the thought. While you're out back, take your John by the ear and put him to better use than wearing out a resting maid. I'll hold back a farthing for his day's labour and all."
The queue writhed as the ladies tossed looks to each other, the tidbit travelling like food through a snake. Connie pursed her lips and went through. The moment she saw the girl, she knew her to be a bad lot. Her berry-brown eyes held a child's boldness, but there was something old in her too. There should have been lines harrowing the high forehead, spots of liverish brown on the dimpled cheeks and hands. She knew at once that this was the snake, her enemy. "Mrs. Bride," John greeted her agreeably, though with an air of some bafflement, "what brings you here?" She looked crossly at the floor. "An errand to run." "What a stink!" the girl cried suddenly. Her thin lips pouted. "Cheese, I trust." "And what else might it be?" snapped Connie. The girl seemed quite amused.
"I'm sorry. I simply have no taste for it."
Connie risked a look at John.
"Good cheese is like good wine, they say. 'Tis age that brings out the full strength and flavour. Takes more to the table."
"I suppose it's good that as milk curdles it stays agreeable," said the girl, her eyes twinkling, "for those who have an appetite for such things."
Connie crossed through to the pantry and set down her basket. She could hear John's low voice and a stifled gasp of scandal from the girl.
"But the whole world speaks ill of her."
The unkind words set Connie's cheeks to crimson. She had been right from the first. This girl had never run from evil. She may have shown evil her back, but only so it might hop on and be carried. Connie bustled back through to the sitting room. John, the bad weather's keeping up, so you must gather in the sheep today.
Just as you say, Mrs. Bride, said John, rising from the chair. Silly creatures, they don't manage well in the snow, she announced, as if to justify her command.
3 winters back we had 2 in a ditch. Fleeces so sodden they couldn't even stand for the weight of them.
Did they die? Asked the girl, wide-eyed.
Connie glanced at her. One did.
You say, Mrs. Bride, said the girl, cheeks dimpling and teeth sharp in her smile. Sheep are such silly creatures.
He stays in his room all the evening. Connie sits alone in the kitchen. Sound carries. She listens to the scurry of his fingers rustling through pages and books slamming shut like little doors. Perhaps he prefers their company to hers after her sharp words this morning. Or is he simply finding a poem to read to the girl, or a passage that has amused him, or the meaning of a certain dream he wishes to share with her? For she knows there is something of an understanding between them. Word has spread through the villages. No one knows the girl. No one has lost her or posted for her return. Were she a few years younger, she would be called a foundling. But Connie suspects the men have other words for her. Connie shivers. She caught the hard look in those berry brown eyes and feels the girl means to harm her. Have I been so wicked, Lord? She wonders aloud and then starts. She has not spoken to him since Charles was taken from her. The thought gives her strange cheer. She knows she will hear no answer to her question, but finds she has chosen to listen regardless. It is Christmas Eve tomorrow. The rustling of John's fingers through the books goes on, but it is like rain on the window pane, or the thin wind calling through the winter trees. Part of the background of things, and you don't really hear it. But John is not dismissed so lightly. She's not sure when in the night he comes to her, but he tells her to meet him in the woods. The girl is outside. She is moving between the cattle, drinking the animal's blood. When she finishes with them, she will come inside the house to feed. He touches Connie's face with one cold hand. He tells her to be ready in an hour. Ready for what? He departs. She dresses, a hard nut of worry budding in her belly. Then she is out of the house, the front way. She thinks she can hear stealthy sounds coming from the byre. She has had a lucky escape. She knows just where to go in the dark. John's tracks mark the thick snow, and she can catch them by moonlight. She follows them into the heart of the forest, even when they grow smaller, like the tracks of an animal. And she emerges from the blackness and the protection of jostling trees into a clearing. The light is better here. The moonlit snow seems to glow. A hand touches on her shoulder. Another clamps around her mouth. All her sense crashes back into her head, but she knows it to be too late. Waking, cold and set shivering, falling through a black, sharp world. She felt no hope, but still clutched at the air for a means to stop her falling. Her hands met John's upon her. He gathered her into him and soothed her, murmuring into her ear like a mother to her babe as her numb thoughts pieced together a truth. The girl lay dead in the snow. There was no blood nor mark, but she was dead all the same, Connie could tell. And lying under a tree was Tom Bledlow in a striped nightgown and cap, frost rhyming his moustaches.
One funeral brings 3, she whispered.
No, said John. It's over now. Tom was breathing, slow and sure as ever he had. There will be others coming from the village, John said, summoned in their sleep to witness. She wanted to make you seem responsible for Tom's death and for mine. A scapegoat, for her to go on feeding. Connie pulled away from him, dizzy with fear.
Feeding?
She took health and succor from the living. Big gulps at first after a dry time alone. Poor Meg Bledlow fed her well, but she needed more. She'd started on Tom when I got here. He's not dead. In a short time he would have been, and I was to follow him. Then you would be found standing over our bodies.
The village folk, you say, she murmured, shivering a little now in the cold. Summoned in their sleep?
He nodded patiently.
As she could take from the body, so she could give to the mind.
She felt he was choosing his words carefully, so she might understand them, but was too dazed and scared to feel slighted.
Place pictures there, images to deceive.
You're not well liked, Connie. You don't court favour. They'd blame your actions on jealousy. They'd call you a witch. Sharp tongues are allies for creatures like her. Connie understood. And with your deaths, she would be sated? No. She would stay here and go on feeding, quietly, living off others. Slowly drain all life from this place. Then shrug off the husk and travel somewhere new. She has done so before. How do you know such things? Breathed Connie. Your books, or is this what you talked of when you sat with her for so long? I sensed something of her nature and wished to find out more to be sure I was right, John murmured. But in truth, Connie, she was familiar to me from the first. She belongs to the worlds I dream of each night. Then, does your mind sicken, John? She glanced down at the girl in the snow, all hunched and coiled, who bore scant likeness now to the bright creature she had been. You poor man, to know such horrors, to walk in your sleep through shades and devilments. This girl is no shade. She's just from somewhere far away. He smiled at her sadly. Now I must leave here. What? I killed the girl. To save a man. There will be a scandal and questions and gossip. A horrible hubbub. So what of it? What of you? She placed her numb hand on his arm. Stay and tell the village what you've told me. Tom Bledler will speak for you, surely. These folk will believe you as I do. I really don't care if they do or do not, he said gently. He seemed at peace as he said it. You belong here. I don't. Still, I'll take some fond memories with me. As will I, she murmured instantly, though in truth she felt none. And there's a chance now for you to wipe clean your slate, John said. Open up your doors and windows and let life back inside. But must you fly? With no home and bad talk against you, you shall be a fugitive. He smiled and cupped her cheek. That holds no fear for me. They heard distant crashes through the thick, brittle undergrowth, noisy footsteps crumping in the snow. John turned and left without another word. There was fearful din over the death of the girl. They laid her out in the church and argued over where to bury her, but she saved them the trouble. Her form crumbled swiftly until nothing was left but a fine black ash. Connie swept the remains out of the church herself and then burnt the broom. The Reverend spoke to a hall jammed full that Christmas Eve night. Tom was in a bad way. Shock, they said, not devilment, but he needed some nursing. Connie had agreed to call in on Christmas Day. After church, she baked a sausage plait. As her plump fingers worked the pastry, she listened to the wind and the rain lashing her glass. Her mind dwelled on the dream she remembered still. If night creatures could place dark pictures in the mind, who then had given her sleep the image of the child taking the tongue of Meg Bledler? To kiss the dead betokens a life to live, the old dream book said. And here she stood, alive. She thought on that. The cottage seemed empty and forlorn with John gone, despite the crackling fire and the salt smell of sausage meat. Connie took a lamp and looked out on the filthy night. She flung open the door and stamped across the puddle-strewn yard to the byre. The warm stink of huddling animals filled her breath as she raised the lamp and stared around at the intricate wreaths and festoons John had hung and left behind. Decorations in a cowshed. Ridiculous. She snatched them all down, one by one, and then carried them inside to brighten her own rooms.
You're right there, Becca. You're still stunned, aren't you?
I'm okay. I was just listening, just like, ooh.
I still can't see you, Becca. I can only see iPhone.
I thought I had my phone. Sorry.
I thought you'd look. There you go.
Very dark in here.
There you are, hiding in the darkness.
Of Southamptonshire.
Always hiding in the darkness.
Oh, down in Southampton, I say.
Indeed.
It's not the worst place in the world.
It's not.
No, I like it.
whenever I would go down to Southampton for doing school visits or things like that, or flying out to the Channel Islands, I would always pop in on Peter Angelides on my way back, just a little bit up the road. So I always associate wrongly Southampton with Peter Angelides, but when I've had to stay over at things like the delightful Premier Inn in Southampton, Peter has driven over to join me for meals and the such like. So yes, very nice, very nice.
Fabulous. Right, let's have a quick chat about the short story for me. So Steve, it was the 25th and final short story in Short Trips, A Christmas Treasury, back in 2004. Do you remember how the commission came about?
As far as I remember, Paul emailed me and asked me if I'd like to contribute a story, which I thought was very nice of him. I don't think I'd had much contact with Paul since we worked on The Shadows of Avalon back in, that would have been probably around about end of 99, start of 2000, I guess. And so it was very nice to be approached. And it was particularly pleasing that he chose my story to end the collection, as he said. It was nice to feel that that was going to be the story left in the mind of the reader, assuming they've been reading in order. And there's no guarantee they were, of course. We can't go back and ask them now. It's too late.
Was it deliberately similar to Totem?
Well, it was echoes of that, yes. Obviously, it's set during the time that the Eighth Doctor is without any of his memories post-burning, well, post-ancestor cell, I should say. But in that period of time where he's catching up with the TARDIS the long way around. And I kind of imagined that he might be just travelling all around the world, really, just making his way, filling his days, trying to regain those memories. And that he would, with the physicality of him, he would quite like situations where, you know, he was like earning his keep in exchange for, you know, giving his labour in exchange for bed and boarding, and becoming involved in the community around him for a brief and limited time before moving on again, basically acting as he did with the TARDIS, except having to do everything the long way round. So, you know, he's not afraid of being a fugitive, he's not afraid of moving on, or doesn't seek acceptance by a community. He maybe seeks to understand them or to help them, but he doesn't need to belong in the way that others do. So, yes, since obviously I had written Totem, and it was almost like, yeah, part two, really, which is why I wanted it to be a Tara story, because it felt like it was written. I had certain stories presented themselves to me as Tara ideas, and I would think, oh, that's a Tara one. It was normally a bit more, I don't know, a bit more of a odd, off-kilter psychological piece rather than a full-on space adventure or something like that. It just felt like that was where Tara operated. So, yeah, I think the idea came. I'd been reading a large book, the British Book of Superstitions, which I was, I think, researching for another story I was writing at the time, a children's fiction story, and was looking up some of the Christmas superstitions and marvelling at how bizarre many of them were, but also the stuff of the devil being able to enter a church through discarded evergreens seemed like a very Doctor Who idea to explore in a Tara Sam sort of way, so right inside the mind of another ordinary person, their life touched by tragedy. At least she knew what happened to her husband, unlike the poor woman in Totem. But that hadn't made it any easier. So that was where it came from, I think. It was imagining, you know, the alien there is fairly tangential to events, but is bringing about another catharsis in the way that that the Doctor does in Totem. So, yes, short answer is I see them as companion pieces. Obviously, this one feels a bit more Doctor Who because it's like full of dark woods and cold night air. You can imagine like the night filming going on, you know, very expensively in with the film crew up all night. So that was what I wanted to do, and it was really nice that Paul liked it enough presumably, to place it there. Unless he was just trying to bury it at the end, I don't know.
So we've all met people who feel like they kind of suck the energy out of you, but I kind of have to ask what inspired the vampire sucking emotions?
Probably I'd been to a party where someone had done exactly that. They'd kind of like sucked all the atmosphere out of the area. You do meet such people, don't you? And it was, yeah, the idea that this thing could actually live, maybe even for years, slowly draining the life force from a community. But at the beginning, when it's hungry, it has to kind of like gulp and gulp. And that's kind of what done it. But it's cunning as well. You know, it knows how to frame somebody, and it knows how to use the emotions of others, play on their fears and play up to their desires perhaps as well. So yeah, it's one of those alien threats. I think it's slightly stronger for not knowing what it is exactly, where it's from, how it got there. We don't know any of that. We can infer, we can imagine, but we don't need to know. And again, I think that was quite a Tara Sams thing about it, is we accept that the alien arrived and then is dispatched, but it's not the most important thing about the story.
How did you enjoy coming back to it 18 years later?
Well, I'd absolutely forgotten it. So it was actually, and I don't have a copy of it. So I was able to track down the text. And yeah, I quite enjoyed it. So that was nice. I'd, as I say, I'd forgotten it. So it's interesting when you rediscover something, and quite nice that there weren't many things I would have changed now. Normally I read back over my stuff and think, oh God, I'd change that, or I don't like that, or I'd want to do something with that. But beyond substituting the odd word here and there as I went, it's just as it was written.
Fantastic. Steve, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you so much for coming along and giving us this little Christmas Day special present and an extra episode, which we weren't originally really planning, but it's always nice to bring somebody a little Christmas surprise. So there you go, Becca. That's
it. Is it's like window number 25 on your advent calendar, isn't it? You know, it's like it shouldn't exist, and yet somehow it does.
Yeah, they're always the best advent calendars because you get the bonus chocolate, and it's usually slightly bigger than the others.
Yeah, exactly. And you've kind of made it all the way through the 24 days, and then it's Christmas. It's like, what, you're not meant to celebrate with a chocolate or something?
Exactly. Crazy. And I think we can say that quite categorically, we are definitely not going to be carrying on and doing an episode a day in December. We are definitely 100% stopping here. We are stopping now, although we have got a New Year's special episode planned. But other than that, we're good.
And Steve and I can safely say that we did not end the world by crossing each other's paths.
No, which was nice. I was slightly concerned, but but it's nice. I mean, I still don't understand how you kept sort of like stepping over me without even noticing I was there. I mean, you're so self-absorbed.
I know. That's the thing. That's because you just like lurking around our vast console room here. That's the beauty of it.
Well, exactly. You know, I don't like to people to trip over me. So.
Yeah. Well, in a few episodes' time, we'll get Colin Brake to redesign it and reshape it for us. We'll go for that.
What a splendid idea! And I'm looking forward to Colin being on here, and so many of the authors. Yeah, it's going to be really nice.
So that's our promise. So in 2023, we'll come back and we'll do some more, but maybe not one a day.
Yeah, very sensible.
Brilliant. Oh, Steve, have a very Merry Christmas. Enjoy the rest of your day. Becca, a very Merry Christmas to you. And of course, to all our listeners, very Merry Christmas to you at home too.
Good Merry Christmas. Merlin's just walked in looking very confused by the hoeing.
He's Merlin the cat, of course. Not Martin Montague's one, Becca's one. So there we go. Anyway, we shall set our controls to dematerialise for the last time this year, and we'll be back on the 1st of January. So until then, everybody, enjoy the rest of the festive season. So it's bye-bye from me, Kenny Smith.
Bye-bye from me, Rebecca Chapman.
Bye-bye from me, Santa Steve Cole.
We'll see you all soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'm the doctor, by the way.